Thanks, John. Well, it's my privilege this morning to introduce to you Professor Tim O'Shea, who's our keynote speaker for the day. It would be fair to say that Tim is extremely well known in the UK and internationally for his work in e-learning. He's definitely one person you could call a pioneer. And in fact, Tim, I think I know your brother Rick, who lives in Australia. But anyway, so he's got links around the world. As I said, Tim is one of these people who really is a pioneer. He started in e-learning before we even called it that, and he was telling me as we were chatting before I got up this morning that he was doing his first programs in the mid-60s in a programming language called Algol, and he went on to become one of the first students in the UK to actually do an O-level in computer science. He completed his PhD in computer-assisted learning in the 70s, and now he finds himself as a senior leader in academia in the UK. So I think you could probably count on one hand the number of vice-chancellors around the world who are running large institutions like universities who have some very strong sense of e-learning and what it can do. Tim's agreed this morning to talk to us about the topic Next Generation Providers, and as you can see, the title of his talk will be called New Topologies for Learning. So can you please join me in welcoming Tim O'Shea? Thank you.
Good morning. Tremendous pleasure to be talking to you, and really very nice to see a lot of old friends in the audience. I will focus mostly on what Terry asked me to talk about, which is next generation providers. But one of the themes that I will want to bring very strongly through the talk is the notion of new topologies for learning. The fact that as we move along with e-learning, we are actually creating new electronic spaces that don't have a straightforward physical counterpart. This talk was prepared with my colleague Eileen Scanlon, who holds professorships at the Open University and at the University of Edinburgh. One of the things that we're most cited for is work we did with a chap called Randall Smith and with somebody called Claire O'Malley, where in the early 90s we took a screen sharing system that Randy Smith had developed called Shared Arc, and we added to the screen sharing system video tunnels designed by a Cambridge scientist called William Newman. And we got these learners, we separated them, and we had them working together on shared simulations, working on shared screens. And we had them also negotiating how they did the task through video tunnels, so a device which wouldn't look too strange now, but 14, 15 years ago looked a little bit strange. And the reason the research had an impact, apart from the fact that this was an odd thing to do, which is, you know, to separate people and then connect them with a shared simulation and connect them via video tunnels, was when we did careful analysis of the joint problem solving done in this medium, it was very clear that the learners and problem solvers were behaving in a way which you can't in the real world, because they were simultaneously side by side, and when they were in different places looking at the screen simulation, it was clear from their language they were using the language of two people sitting side by side at a terminal. But when they were negotiating about the task, they were clearly behaving, and that was obvious in the eye contact and the head movement and such, like two people who were face to face, and they were doing those things. And of course, in the real world, you can't be simultaneously side by side and face to face. And so we published some stuff on that, which had an impact for various reasons. But one of the reasons it had a very strong impact on myself and Eileen is that it was very, very clear that we had constructed with Randy Smith and William Newman an electronic space which had no physical counterpart. And I think it is quite important, as e-learning develops, to look at the ways in which the things that we are helping students use to support their learning, the way that quite often now they don't have a physical counterpart. Here's a prediction, which I'm going to argue against. Peter Drucker, writing in Forbes magazine about 9 years ago, IT progress will mean the end of the residential university by 2030. It'll be replaced by personalised technologies for learning. There have been lots of predictions, and people started making predictions about computers and education immediately in the post-war period. I've got some very nice Reader's Digest articles from the mid-50s about the electronic university of the future. So here's a quote from Drucker, and I'm going to argue very strongly against the proposition he's got here. Here's the structure of the talk. I'm going to start by telling you what I think an ideal next generation provider might be, talk about actual next generation providers, a little bit on the history of e-learning, talk about some recent technological innovations. Then I'll give you some nice exemplars, and I'm going to be horribly parochial and boastful. All the very nice exemplars will be drawn from current University of Edinburgh practice. Then I'll talk to you about some themes and issues, and I'm basically a very optimistic person, so then I will give you reasons for being optimistic. What might an ideal next-generation provider look like? Well, you'd certainly want a comprehensive online curriculum. You'd want personalised support. It really would be nice if you had a group of peers learning alongside with you in the same time frame that you had some access to. You'd like the administration of the learning and the learning itself to be integrated when you're checking things like your fee status and your exam status. You don't really want to be using some sort of entirely different mode. You'd certainly like to be mobile. Students are very keen on wireless, keen on PDAs. And you'd certainly like a blended mode. You wouldn't like to be told you can only use the computer. You would want to use a book or a videotape or a lab as appropriate. You would really want high integrity from your provider, and you'd want your degrees to be respected. And strong universities are certainly good on number two and number three, and they're certainly good on the last two. Most universities have very comprehensive curricula, but they certainly aren't online. A lot of universities at the moment certainly have difficulty integrating admin and learning and difficulty with mobile and blended modes. Also, there's lots of nice pilot work. But in this talk, I'm going to argue strongly that it is the big research universities that are best placed for the future to be the next generation providers. If you look at a major university, obviously there's lots of research-led learning. It permeates it. Major universities tend to have massive assets. In our case, we have a library with 3 million volumes, all sorts of other things. And like other major universities, like Harvard and Stanford, we are busily digitizing. One of the interesting things that's happening with new technology is the role of the curator is being extended. We have more and more people doing curation. It will be digital curation, but it is still definitely curation. Most of the major universities are weak on integrated administration and weak for remote students. The Open University is the counterexample for those two. It's got a highly integrated administration, and it is designed for students at a distance. But the typical research university isn't very good with those. Typical university is really struggling with assessment and trying to figure out what to do with assessment as students are increasingly using technology more and more. But the major universities do have a history of awarding degrees, and if somebody says, I've got a degree from Edinburgh or I've got a degree from Cambridge, that has a certain meaning. Who are the other providers? Well, the other providers are obviously new private universities that have come into being because of the opportunity. They're the publishing houses, they are software houses, and then there are a number of special purpose providers. It's perfectly possible for other providers to be much more responsive and flexible than a big university. Very often they'll be much closer to a particular piece of new technology, have much more ease crossing borders. I mean, we have something called the Bologna process at the moment, where people are banging their heads at comparing undergraduate education in I was going to say the UK, and I shouldn't, of course, because we actually bang our heads within the UK, where we have the fine Scottish four-year degree, which has been copied around the world, and then we have the idiosyncratic, narrow English three-year degree. So we have actually got some quite severe problems crossing borders within the UK, and then once you start looking at French, German, or Italian conventions. So universities, if they're providing awards, have obvious structural difficulty crossing borders. Clearly, if you're an international publishing house, you're across the borders anyway. Other providers may be able to provide integrated solutions, but they lack an environment with lots of researchers and lots of curators. They have very limited assets. I mean, University of Edinburgh has 7,500 staff. The majority of them have actually got a research function. We have got a reasonable number of curators, certainly comparable to a middling-sized museum. And we, in fact, have a number of small museums in them. The other providers typically aren't going to have those. And then the issue is the value of the award. What does it mean to get an award from a completely private, brand-new provider? And how do you get an award which actually turns into genuine educational currency? So the universities have certain advantages. The other providers have certain advantages. Just to talk a little bit about the models we use, working with Eileen, we've given a paper a couple of times recently, looking at the different psychological models that people have deployed. And it's just worth reminding ourselves that the business of applying computers in education started very early, applying Skinnerian models of reinforcement, then notions of association. And really, e-learning has been tracking the different psychological developments, obviously with Piagetian and Vygotskian modes coming along. But there is a sort of an exercise which needs to be worked through in greater detail. But you know, some people at the moment writing about next-generation learning write as if learning was a simple, well-understood thing. Well, you can certainly find at least 8 serious branches of the psychology of learning being deployed explicitly or implicitly by different designers. Here's another of my favourite quotes, Pat Supi's. One can predict that a few more years, this is 1966, millions of school children will have access to what Philip of Macedon's son, a tutor as well-informed and responsive as Aristotle. And Pat Supi's, by the way, has made resources, made money out of integrated learning environments, but I don't think the ready comparison with Aristotle is quite available yet. The other thing to remind you is the different benefits we get from deploying the technology in the learning environment are very varied. Again, work that Eileen and I did for UNESCO, we identified 14 different types of enhancements that you get, and one can go through those. But the point I'm wanting to make is that e-learning isn't a simple thing. It is not that there is a simple model of psychology we can deploy. I can identify at least 8. And there isn't a simple dimension of enhancement. One can identify here at least 14. One of the most interesting and surprising ones was Tom Malone in his early work, which I think still has a lot of potential. Tom Malone's Stanford thesis was entitled What Makes Computer Games Fun to Learn? And he's the first person to, using Piagetian ideas, produce both theoretical argument and some very nice data to demonstrate the different types of motivational effects you could get in computer games. And that sort of work, it would be very helpful to see more of. What are the technology drives? You all know this, but Moore's Law, the World Wide Web, radio frequency identification and portable object-oriented programming, voice over internet, virtual learning environments, constant connectivity, and high fidelity 3D virtual realities. I mean, the interesting thing for me about these 7 drives or 7 drivers is that they've all individually got about 10 years to go. So you're very lucky, though most of you look much younger than me. So you've got at least 10 very exciting years because these technology drives will have a very big impact. And when you go to conferences like this, quite often people will explain to you that this or that they're doing is not technology-driven. It is driven by some point of educational principle. And it is nearly always balderdash. If it's an old person like myself who has tracked all the waves of development in individualization, the national development for computer-assisted learning, the sudden move into collaborative learning, it is very easy to relate the new developments at this conference, at Cal and others, to technological drivers. And there are two reasons for that. One is the technological drivers are very powerful, and the students have access to them regardless of what the institution does. I was talking to the man who owns Dixon's, and they have an immensely busy period when they sell about a third of their PCs. Anybody want to guess when that is? Pardon? No, it's the day after the A-level results. I go each year and greet University of Edinburgh students as they arrive at halls of residence. 4 years ago, there were lots of dads struggling with boxes. Now, for the most part, you can't see the computers, but we know they're there. We know they're little there. And an awful lot of them are wireless laptops. So the technology driver is very, very powerful, A, because it changes what we can do, and B, because it's completely outside the control of the institutions. The students go and buy it anyway. So we will continue to see big changes driven by what the technology offers us. And for me, one of the strongest examples of that was computer-supported collaborative learning. People did not sit down and read Vygotsky and say, let there be computer-supported collaborative learning. What instead happened was people noticed that people were doing asynchronous and synchronous group learning using things like conferencing and email, and then they tried to make sense of it, and that was the point at which they started trying to understand Russian psychologists. It's a good thing to try to understand Russian psychologists. We just shouldn't overemphasize how far along the way we are on that process. I do think the different models of learning need to be amplified. Recent events. So now we've got on the planet more than a billion internet users, so about one in six. A quarter of them, I don't know why they do it or how they do it, but a quarter of them read blogs. And we have 10 billion uses of Google a day. I thought that had to be wrong. I did a little check in my corridor before coming here, and I was getting numbers. The smallest number I got, apart from my own, was 12. I was getting numbers like 20 and 30, and I just went and checked the admin corridor. So at least 10 billion Google users a day. Very, very sad event for Edinburgh. Encyclopedia Britannica, which was originally Encyclopedia Edinburgh, and then turned into Encyclopedia Chicago, if you know the history. The Encyclopedia Britannica was run by publishers in Edinburgh and then was bought by Chicago. But it isn't doing that well when you compare it with Wikipedia. So we have that going along. We have YouTube with videos. We have MySpace with egos. I speak with feeling as a parent of four teenagers. And then for me, particularly exciting, we have portable object oriented technology and speckled computing. We have a big program in speckled computing at the University of Edinburgh. And there's some very, very nice sun technology. The most alarming thing I saw, or entertaining thing I saw, was some very nice devices that Sun have got, which have got computer set specs and have got accelerometers on them. So these are devices which can tell if they've been shaken. And what you get is little object-oriented programs running away, on one of these, and you can program it to do various things and interact with the world in all sorts of entertaining ways. The thing that struck me most in the demo I saw recently at Sun was you can program one of these programs to, whenever it's been shaken too much, find the nearest device like this, which is shaking less, and transmit itself to there and continue running there. And that, you know, if you're worried about viruses and bugs, then now you should start getting seriously worried. But very interesting, if you want an educational example, obviously you put one of these with a Wii camera and a battery next to, let's say, a badger set. It goes to sleep. It waits until there's a little bit of movement, wakes itself up, and then starts sending you messages. And obviously video images of the badger coming out of the set or whatever. So all sorts of very nice educational applications. And if you haven't seen it, either go and look at the speckled computing at the University of Edinburgh or look at Sunspot at Sun Microsystems. Edinburgh, we've got a whole range of contexts, and I'm going to argue that one of the reasons why some of our e-learning work is so very, very strong is because our research is so very strong. We've housed DigiMap, and we have Edina, which does wonderful work, very good relationship with JISC, housed with Glasgow, the UK's eScience Centre, with the CCLRC, we house the UK's High Performance Computing Centre, and with Glasgow and Bath and the CCLA, we house the UK's Digital Curation Centre. And an advantage a research university has, if it's got functions like that, is that when people in other parts of the university are trying to deploy e-learning in its different forms, or whether it's enhancing a simulation or enhancing dialogues, they do have, as it were, within the institution, access to tremendous resources and experience. And I'll show you a little bit about the award-winning stuff that Professor Dewhurst and Rachel Holloway and colleagues have done in medicine and veterinary medicine, which I like very much because I've got a bit of a farming background, so you'll get vet examples. We have got a wonderful School of Divinity, which again has been winning awards for its work. And the thing that is interesting to me about the incredibly good e-learning of the Edinburgh School of Divinity is it is based on digitized cultural assets. It really does depend on having a library and having curators and curators who understand the value and importance of the different 200, 300, 400, 500-year-old texts, as well as having the people who know the technology of digitizing. And then one which I think is very important, although it's tremendously bad news for bread and breakfast owners in the northwest of Scotland, is every year in Scotland there is a nice newspaper article which goes, University of Edinburgh scientists finally beat the midge problem. This year's version is Midge Alert. It's a very nice interactive map. It's based on models and obviously maps of Scotland. And you can get a five-day, if you want a five-day midge forecast for Ardnamurchan or for Aberdeen, it is there. It is wonderful. It is obviously part of the learning experience we offer, but I would argue that as well as having biologists who really understand nasty little things like midges, we also needed people who knew about the maps. So we won the Queen's Anniversary Prize for our work in computer-assisted learning, supporting medics and supporting medical undergraduates and veterinary undergraduates. One of the things we've got in there are virtual patients. One of the great strengths of what Professor Dewhurst and colleagues have done is we provide chronological support. So if you're studying medicine at the University of Edinburgh, you start using this system. 5 years later, you're still using it, and you have very good access to what you did in the first year. So it runs through the five-year course. We also have this very nice simulated patient called George. To start with, George is a fairly simple, abstract person. Then George turns into a hybrid person. So, for example, there's a version of George with a physical arm, and you try to stick a needle in, and the computer tells you, and the rest of George is virtual, and you get told off if you don't put the needle in the right place. And then George gets more elaborate and has a chest and has heart attacks. And medics, being the playful people that they are, of course, right at the very end of the 5 years, as the students are about to graduate, George inevitably dies. We have an electronic portfolio, so it isn't just that they have the chronology of what they've done. The different electronic resources are very well organized for them. And that approach, which has been pioneered in medicine, has been deployed. And I'll give you a couple of examples of it being deployed elsewhere. Again, that is, I think, an advantage an institution with a lot of resources can have, which is you can, provided you do it right, you can say, how can we give you electronic access to the resources you were using 2 years ago, 3 years ago, which are being used in this or that specialized course? And then this is a particular electronic resource which gives students access to information about different drugs. And then we come on to the vets. I love the vets. I think they're really great. I'm not going to show you. I got a horrible fright because I was shown image of the week from the virtual post-mortem room. Fortunately, I wasn't eating my dinner. But we have a virtual post-mortem room, and for people who like looking at the guts of animals who died in interesting ways, well, this is the place to go. We have the virtual farm, and it's the University of Edinburgh is very lucky. It actually has multiple farms. And just as a little segue, I mean, as an artificial intelligence person, I was absolutely delighted to discover that on our dairy farm, now with artificial intelligence colleagues working with vet colleagues, we have high-quality, random-access robot milking. But that's not to do with this talk. What we do provide the students with who can't trek out to our farms or who may be somewhere else, is we actually provide them with an electronic virtual farm, which is basically the various electronic information based from the different farms. So as well as the real farms that you can go to look at the sheep and to look at the cows and such, you can also use the virtual farm. And you can also, the vets are the one group that beat us when we tried to reorganise semesterisation, and we had to juggle everything around because the vets said that it was impossible for them to move the timing of lambing. And if I wanted to move the timing of lambing, I could, but they couldn't. But if you've got with the virtual farm, one of the things you can do, of course, is you can track the progress towards lambing and get yourself trundling off to the virtual farm at the right time. I've been talking about a veterinary and medical portfolios. We also have nice industrial placement portfolios. And it is a really quite a nice concept of putting together the different resources, both the chronology of what the student has done, but also resources they have used and resources that they might use. Here's another quote. I like these Sun conferences. I learn a lot from them, and I was preparing this talk, going through my notes, but Scott McNeely really did say in 2004, books are so last millennium. And I guess if you're trying to do e-learning from a base where you don't have as part of your infrastructure libraries with millions of physical books, you might say that. From our point, it is becoming clearer and clearer to the University of Edinburgh, as it has become clear to Harvard and Stanford also, that actually having massive libraries is a serious asset when you are engaged in e-learning developments. So here are some slides from the wonderful work that is done in our library. We have now got a Google-like search on our... And, of course, we have massive electronic library resources and journals as well. We've got a quick search. Goes at a reasonable lick. One of the most important things about it from my point of view is it's got images, because one of the great assets of the university is tremendous numbers of scientific diagrams, scientific pictures, you know, the geological diagrams that Hutton used, the physical model that when Crum Brown, one of our chemists, came up with the ball and stick model for molecules, he actually did it with his wife's knitting. With balls of wool and knitting needles. And we have got nice visual images available of that. And we will end up with an enriched presentation of the library catalogue. So we have tremendous resources, and in terms of understanding subjects deeply, having access to the historical artefacts or the historical pages is very important. As I said, one of the groups that have really taken tremendous advantage of our digitised library treasures are the School of Divinity. And the University of Edinburgh has 21 schools. The School of Divinity is probably the most noticeable one if you know you're looking at it. If you stand on Princes Street, you'll see a castle. If you look to the left of the castle, you'll see a Gormenghast-like thing that looks sort of like another castle with two great big black towers with crenellations on top. That is the University of Edinburgh Divinity School. But despite all its wonderful history, it is really out in front in terms of using resources. And I would encourage you to go to their website, which will give you a very nice tour. And we have got these, again, this is a set of electronic resources for people studying people, prelates, and purgatory. And that's another... Oh, there we are. Now you can see the School of Divinity. You see the thing with the two tallest towers with the crenellation. That's the University of Edinburgh School of Divinity. which has got its own wonderful divinity library, which is supported by people around the world and visited, by people around the world. And here we are in languages, another portfolio, just again to make the point that we have all these various resources. And then lastly, as an example, we have a very nice system called ActiveMaths. It's the, as it were, the modern version of what I did my PhD on in the 70s. It's focused on learning material tailored to the student's needs. It's got a proper learning model to help the student with difficulties. Here is some dialogue boxes showing the type of statement the student types, what they send. Here is a labelling of the different content. And we've left that now and on to navigation. And I guess one of the things we're all probably very aware of is the effect portable devices have. People running around, and certainly we offer support for our geology students, and we're a whole sort of mix from virtual field trips to physically enacted field trips with electronic support. One thing that is quite problematic for learners, though, is navigation support. It doesn't just apply if you're running out in the field using GPS to get some information about where you are and linking back. There really are profound topological issues. If you're in an information space, a lot of people who build information spaces aren't strongly aware of the topology. They're not saying to themselves, is it a tree? Are there recursive links? Is it a network? But you do actually need, as the things get non-trivial size, and one of the reasons things like Google work well is because the people who built that really did understand the topology of information spaces. A lot of the stuff we build ourselves turns out to have funny structures, funny repetitions, funny loops. But for a modern student, a modern learner, if they're in learning in some electronic space, they'd like to know, well, how's it shaped? Is there anybody else there? How can I plan my route? If I'm in a space where I'm learning some vet stuff, but I want to learn some entrepreneurship, how can I travel between the spaces? And I may want to learn in parallel in both spaces. How can I do that? And we need more help for doing that. Just a comment on virtuality. We see virtuality being deployed all over the place. Why is it beneficial? Well, it reduces memory load, structures experience. What's the key metaphor? The key metaphor is clear. It's direct manipulation, which is very funny for that to be the key metaphor, but it is. It's the notion that your virtual microscope or your virtual sheep or your virtual library is something that you can directly move, and you will have the mouse will turn into a hand or a switch or something, or the mouse equivalent. And nice examples, virtual microscope. Open University has a virtual summer school. Virtual university, the small prize, unless somebody's heard me say this before. Who came up with the term virtual university?
Neil Slater.
Pardon?
Neil Slater.
No, Neil Slater did not come up with the term virtual university. Huh? Who? Did somebody? Any other suggestions? It is interesting. This is... when I give a talk like this, this is my source book, Ted Nelson... Computer Lib and the Dream Machine, 1974. Whenever I read a paper about our area and it says recently or such, I go to see which page Ted Nelson has described it. Great masses of stuff are there. Some stuff isn't. World Wide Web isn't, although obviously semantic networks are. Virtual University is not there, but the person who coined the term was Cardinal Newman. And it was a pejorative. He was attacking the University of London because he said the University of London was, for a part of its history, an examining-only body. You just registered with it. It was basically an exam structure. And he said, and it was a pejorative, London University was a virtual university. A real university should know its students in the way that a parent knows their children. So for me, virtual university is a slightly dodgy concept, and certainly you have got to bring in a question of, and how is it that the institution is going to know you as well as, at least as well as a real university? And then you have some other funny notions like virtual reality, and we've been talking about virtual libraries as extensions to real libraries. So let me give you, I'm closing now, let me give you a few themes. There'll just be a couple more slides. The technology push is very, very important, and we've got at least 10 years of it on at least seven dimensions. The globalization pull is very important. It is. We now have world league tables of universities. We have universities working very hard to be international players. I was at a conference of senior vice chancellors in April in New Zealand, and somebody was explaining to us that while the Europeans and the Chinese would be, as they are, very keen on world league tables of universities to see where, you know, where Oxford or where Beijing University was positioned, the Americans would never do that because they were so inward-looking. This August, Newsweek published a world table of universities. University of Edinburgh, 47th, which we'd use a little bit higher, but 47th on that. Harvard, obviously, number one, as you'd expect from the US World League table. Times, of course, you get Cambridge number one, Harvard number two. So they're interesting. There's obviously a cultural aspect. Although these World League tables tend to put people in more or less the same place. But there is universities now very, very aware of the need to be global players, and e-learning is part of that. Blended learning, very important, but not new. I mean, you could certainly have no difficulty applying the concept of blended learning as it is preached now to the very first open university learning products. What is very important is intellectual asset management. How do you allow learners, allow your researchers, allow communities to exploit what you've got without being massively exploited as an institution? That's difficult. Personalization, podcasting, real opportunities there. Assessment and authentication, absolutely vital. I mean, people fuss about plagiarism, but actually personification is a much trickier thing. How do we know the person who's logged in is the person they say they are, rather than is the person who is logged in copying something from somewhere else? And then I've been arguing strongly that we do need to look at the new types of spaces that are created. Issues, just to get gloomy. Security, if you look at chief information officers working in the IT industries, what is the number one thing they're concerned about above even resources? The single thing they're most concerned about is security and identity management. And that is a very annoying thing, because by pouring money into it, as we have to, we're not actually obviously improving the immediate learning experience of our cohorts of learners. But it is quite inescapable. Object economy, the whole argument for object-oriented programming, one of the key issues is sustainability, reuse. You want to use an object standard which will survive. You want to reuse those objects. How to do that? Quite complicated. Very nice article by Andy DeSessa in Interactive Learning Environments 2004. Something that is continuing is Scott Kim wrote a paper, published a paper a couple of months ago on 3D virtual environments and how they add to science learning. This is at Stanford. And he discovered that there was an improvement, but there was no significant statistical difference. And there is quite a lot of evaluation work which leaves us boxed there. So that is an issue. One would like to see some more statistically robust stuff. There are issues around the digital divide and disconnect, or digital disconnect, however you want to say it. Clearly, interoperability is vital. I mean, if you look at just how quickly systems, and for that matter, companies go away, open standards and how they are best to be deployed. And in the educational world, robust assessment models. Assessment models that are meaningful in terms of how the kids use the computers, but at the same time give complete integrity to the qualification currency. If you want to learn about these things, these themes and issues, then you should immediately enrol for the University of Edinburgh MSc in e-learning. It'll teach you about next generation spaces, and virtual worlds, and my colleagues Frank Lassard and Sean Pankhurst have already got a nice website. Places are limited, so do get a, you know, long. They'll talk to you about educational applications of Wikipedia, talk to you about integrating Web 2.0 with VLEs, and even has got some nice photos of them. So do think about joining that course. I know that some of you are obviously beyond that, but I think some of you will benefit, and some of you might even be refreshed by it if you're not totally up to date on blogging and wikis. Concluding then, why am I optimistic? Because we've got some serious people, Alan Turing, Vannevar Bush, Robert Moore, Alan Kay, there's some serious people who have made predictions about where the technology is going, which have turned out right, and their predictions have still got some miles. We've got a robust sector. I was a member of the JISC the day before Janet 6 came out, which coincided with a WorldCom event. We've seen WebCT. One of the biggest projects I was engaged in was producing authoring systems for computer-based training for ICL. Now, there are lots of changes, and yet, you know, we continue. The field moves along. I am very impressed by the way students use Google. Within Scotland, I'm extremely impressed by the University of the Highlands and Islands. Covers a massive space. And the thing, 19 participating institutions, including the Gaelic College on Skye. And the thing that impresses me the most about it is the matter-of-fact way technology, like the video links and the other, is being used there. It's not charged in any way. It's not go to the special video conferencing room. It's just kicking around, and people in Inverness and Perth are quite comfortably chatting to people in Skye. Another thing that makes me very optimistic is the Royal College of Art annual show. If you've not been to one, you should go. They recruited somebody who worked with Randy Smith and myself in Cambridge, Bill Gaver, and Bill Gaver added the sound to the shared arc system. I was a little bit puzzled about why would the Royal College of Art want to recruit somebody as techie as Bill Gaver. If you go around the show, you will find all these lovely things, all these exhibits which you either interact with via your mobile phone, or cause your BlackBerry to do something weird, or do something weird and ask you to look at your machine, and that's to see the different modalities, and it's interesting to see the way that touch is coming along, interesting to see the developments with smell. I'm still looking forward to smell-o-vision before I retire. So it isn't just pictures and sounds, there is touch. But the RCA annual show is a very good thing to look at. Another thing that I find very inspiring is the Earth Lab, the way all these educational institutions, different parts of the world, pull stuff together. JISC and Janet are an extraordinary UK success. And I led the charge, as it were, or the defence. The only thing the British vice-chancellors are unambiguously agreed can be top-sliced for in the sector, that is, money just taken in proportion to the size of institution without further argument, is for Janet. And a roaring success. And then the other thing that makes me very optimistic is looking at the big institutions like Edinburgh, Stanford, MIT that have got strong computing capability, seeing how that is going through. So my answer to the next generation providers is very clear. Drucker is wrong. The next generation providers will be big universities, mostly the research-led universities, because they have the appropriate assets, they have the research environment. Thank you very much indeed for listening to me.
Thank you very much, Tim, for what I found to be a very engaging and interesting discussion. We have time now for about 10 minutes for some questions, and you'll notice that there are some microphones in the audience if people would like to pose a question to Tim. So, there's one up the back there, please.
Dana.
Well, thank you. I found a lot of that very interesting. A couple of things that I was curious about. One is that you kill off George at the end of their degree. and related to that, e-portfolios, and a whole load of other stuff. It seems to me that at the moment, while you're a member of the university as a student, you've got access to all these things, and then when you leave, you've killed off George. And I was wondering how sort of that relates to CPD, and maybe he should actually be getting senile or whatever it is as they leave, and things like e-portfolios and continued access, and therefore how that also relates to things like MySpace, and whether we should actually be doing our learning through things like that, where they have continued access throughout their life, rather than having to use all these systems when they come to Edinburgh and then, or wherever, and then drop them when they move on.
I think that is an absolutely excellent question, and I think you're right. And I think particularly if you look at the potential for ECPD, but also the potential for keeping students as part of some ongoing community, certainly we shouldn't, as it were, kill off George and say, that's it, you're no longer a matriculated student. I mean, I would have to be, I know if Professor Dewhurst is in the audience, he may want to jump up and contradict me. I would have to say that I think we have a distance to go in various dimensions, including the university regulations, in how it is we ensure that successful alumni remain active electronic members of the university community, because you want them to, you know, you want people who are learning to be vets in different locations to have easy access to their peer cohort to exchange the time when a simulated dog patient died and is the, you know, the dog in front of them at the moment, like that one or not, or whatever the case is. I think you're exactly right, and I think if the universities were to successfully solve that, I think that would give us, again, a major advantage over non-university providers. Because there's a world of difference between saying, OK, now I'm taking the we have an electronic forensic science course, but unless Professor Dewhurst contradicts me, I would be fairly confident that if you took that as a University of Edinburgh medical graduate, you wouldn't have any access to yourself as an undergraduate. And that's a great, terrible pity, because you did 5 years, you accumulated all sorts of notes, but now you're this new person with apparently no previous connection to the university who is taking the electronic MSc in forensic science or in palliative medicine. No, an absolutely excellent point. I think you've just given us a job to do, which I think we ought to attack.
You quoted earlier Peter Drucker indicating that the residential university would die by 2030, and you challenged that. But would you say that in view of the changes that are happening, that the university needs to change its essential organisational structures, or is it merely a question of adopting new tools or something in between?
I mean, the two separate things. I mean, you know, one thing that jumps out at me when Drucker says residential is the fact that we've got 6,000 study bedrooms. And if you ask what is the university doing about that, the answer is very simple. We're adding to it. Because even when people have access to us electronically, they really do want to spend time in Edinburgh. They may not want to spend 4 years. They may not want to spend even 1 year. But they certainly want to spend time here. So we certainly see, and we see, you know, we have a very strong... We have 1,300 US students, for example. They really do want to come to Edinburgh as part of their learning experience. In terms of how universities are organised, I mean, the University of Edinburgh itself engaged in a simplification 4 years ago, which has been very helpful. And as part of that, we have a single vice principal for knowledge management, and she is in charge of both the library, but also the computing service, the learning and teaching service, and a lot of the other electronic functions that impact learning. And having a single zone, the university basically has six big budget holders, three running colleges, three running services, and because of the scale of our library and such, it's appropriate that we actually have a vice principal. And that is a development that has worked for us, and other universities have noticed it. I mean, it seems to me hard not to look at the different types of information services you're providing and to say, well, you want to, within the university, look at that as a piece, because you know, as the examples I showed you, I mean, it would have been odd if the people in the School of Divinity, you know, one minute were talking to a librarian in the library service about the book, and next minute talking to somebody in the computing service about scanning pages. I mean, it's the same enterprise, and in our university, it's run from the same place. And certainly, so I think universities have some scope to adapt. And I think as the technologies develop, one has to look at the organisational structure. And I think there are examples of universities with organisational structures which are really not very fit for purpose in the contemporary environment. I would say the Edinburgh one is really on the good side, but there's still obviously scope for improvement there. And clearly needs looked at. I mean, very few universities have the privilege of the Open University of being able to design a management structure before coming into being. There's one there.
Thank you very much. I was just wondering if you would care to speculate in light of the comment that the contentious comment that the traditional universities were the new generation providers. Yeah. What the role might be for those institutions that are, you know, have a less prestigious address or heritage or resources or are serving slightly different constituencies in the context of the so-called widening participation debates. Is it through partnerships or what? How do those of us that are somewhere below that number 47 level respond to our needs and requirements as, I mean, we all have to be new generation providers because, you know, we're at the same state of evolution.
Well, I think that the two aspects, I think one is partnership, and I think electronic facilities make that easier. And I think increasingly, you know, for competitive advantage, universities will go into partnerships. I mean, the University of Edinburgh has 100 non-trivial funded partnerships with other institutions in Scotland. It has 100 seriously funded partnerships, of which the biggest is the Stanford Link, which is about 7 million, with universities outside of Scotland. And it has more than 100 partnerships with institutions in the private sector. I mean, even a university our size, we're sort of four times the size of the average British university, there are lots of resources we don't have, and therefore we go finding partners and or people with complementary. So I think that's part of it. I think where quite a lot of the new universities have an advantage is on the personalisation and providing high-quality feedback. In my experience, I mean, if you look at the National Student Survey, then the two serious players right at the top are the Open University and Birkbeck. And that's not surprising because those are institutions which operate to a very much higher standard of learner support because of the diversity of backgrounds of their learners and because the learners, you can't just say to them, come back into the lab in an hour's time. Come and see me this evening. So I think, and my experience is that some of the new universities do have a sort of quality of student support. I mean, obviously, we are working very hard at our university to improve, to support. But there is, and it is like, I mean, the best instruction I ever had, the most thorough, was from the Army. And the Army taught me how to make a superhet radio and how to strip a Bren gun in the dark and all sorts of arcane. The Army taught me how to teach. You know, tell them what you're going to tell them what you told them. The reason I was bringing the Army in is that what the Army teaches things. I went to the REME at Arborfield to learn electrical engineering. Why does the Army teach electrical and electronic engineering to such a very high standard? It does it for two reasons. It does it because it's got a very diverse student body who really may not be very well equipped. And it really would be very embarrassing for the tank to blow up. So there is a real imperative for military training. And I think some of the newer providers are, in some sense, they're nearer the Army than they are Oxford. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing in terms of being a learning provider. But I think there is an issue there, because I certainly, the view I would take fairly determinedly is, since coming to Edinburgh, it has become clearer and clearer to me that having a massive library with a big curating function and having a massive research function that uses an awful lot of IT is hell of a helpful when you're doing ordinary e-learning. And clearly, most institutions don't have that. Any others?
Tim, I think we're running to a pretty tight schedule, so we might call it a halt there. Right. Can I just say once again, thank you very much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to come and talk to us.